No, I'm still okay. Nope. That is all in the blue. Okay. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Nice of us all to come. When I'm in physical pain and I can differentiate myself from it, what I realize is that I feel the pain more when I focus on it, and when I focus on my being, I can feel pain less, but it's still there. But this is to a certain extent. And if the pain becomes severe, it doesn't help to differentiate myself from pain. I think my biggest fear is to have constant pain that doesn't go away, and I can't distract myself from it. Then how can there be freedom from pain, really? Yes, Atma is free from pain, but the body is still there in pain. Yeah, that's true. I think when there is such a thing, you know, people having chronic pain because of, well, it could be arthritis or something has happened, and so they have to learn how to handle severe pain, and that's constant, continual pain. The body does certain things. The body and mind do certain things to adjust to that pain, where it kind of, you know, it's kind of like white sound. That white sound is where there's a low noise frequency, and somehow your mind kind of learns how to handle it or almost negate it because it's a constant. And so I know in the States, I'm sure in all over Europe also, there's chronic pain centers where they actually train you using biofeedback techniques and things like that in order to learn how to have pain management, because it is a real issue. As long as you have a body, no matter what your attitude is, it's not that pain goes away. So there's different techniques and things to learn how to handle it, and the body also has ways of handling it. When it becomes chronic and it's just there, then you find ways of adjusting to it, but you know, it's not an easy thing because the body's capable of tremendous pain. When Swamiji was getting his, you know, he had several bypass surgeries, and in one of those bypass surgeries, they were putting in a heart monitor or something. That was part of the surgery. And when they did that, they nicked his artery or something. And so there was this internal bleeding that was taking place. He would have died in a very short period of time. So they had to tear his heart open and pull it up and try to stop that, that bleeding. So he talked about that to some of us. It was through in the hospital, and he was just telling what that was like. And this is Swamiji so much. He says, I was able to maintain my objectivity, he said, but I almost couldn't because the pain was so severe. So the body is capable of such severe pain that it can just totally overwhelm. He said that he felt that he almost got overwhelmed from it. Then one of the I'm just acknowledging the reality of having a body, physical body, and the pain that it can cause. a Nayarji who is the accountant at the Coimbatore Ashram, maybe some of you know him, has completely white gray hair. He's kind of a good looking man who's maybe in his around 60, 65 or so. He's a very quiet guy. He had last year he had a severe, it was longer because Swamiji was still with us then, so maybe it was 3 years ago. He had a severe heart attack, and he almost died from that. But he was telling Edward that he has never experienced anything like that, you know, so you have the experience, and then you do what you can with it, you know. It's not like that's an easy thing to handle. You're having extremely severe pain, and then you have to be with that in some way or another. So those things you can't really prepare for, like if you're having a heart attack or something like that, because it's unexpected, it's not chronic, and you're just kind of hit with this shocking amount of pain. The only thing that would maybe, that I can imagine would be different for a jnani and an ajnani, that could be different, that could be the same for the ajnani also, is that there's none to minuscule amount of buildup upon our experiences. It's not that you don't have the experience, but the secondary buildup upon the experience, like the kind of why me, or how could Bhagawan do this to me, and all of this, you know, the kind of creating emotional pain around the painful experience, even any kind of painful experience, and there can be the secondary painful reaction to the painful experience. And so that would not be there, but that doesn't mean that the pain's not there. The physical pain, it is there. So we have to be with it to the best of our ability. I don't know what else to say. You know. But yeah. That's what we get for having a body. That's why that's also what makes me think of, I'm sure I've told you this before, but several years ago now, a group of us went out to a restaurant and with the intention of getting to know this very, very well-known yogi, woman yoga teacher, who had quite a reputation in the States, and she happened to be a good friend of one of our colleagues. So about six of us went out to dinner, and so that nice conversation. She's the one that said, said, you know, it's better to spend an hour a day taking care of yourself now than 24 hours a day later. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. So do what you can. Mm-hmm. You have to not abuse the body, and to give it what it needs, you know, give it the exercise it needs, the type of food that it needs, get enough sleep, that kind of thing, so that you treat it as that a temple. In India, that's where they put the chandasana, the kumkum on. You bathe it every day, and you think of it as something that is the Lord's temple, because it is, because the self is Ishwar, you know. So you have that attitude toward it, where you care for it. And I think that's a really good idea, to minimize the illnesses that come our way because of abuse, really. Sugar. all kinds of things. So anyway. I can't answer that question very well, except to acknowledge the truth of it. Can you say that Ishwara's forms are all just different expressions of Brahman? Mm-hmm. Ishwara's forms means everything. Absolutely everything in the creation is just part of the expression of the Maya, of Ishwara, and Ishwara is just Brahman with the Maya, which is Mithya. So it's an incidental attribute of Brahman. So there is nothing in the creation that is not a manifestation, you know, doesn't belong to the creation. So then you can say, well, is like Ravana in the Mahabharata, I mean in the Ramayana, who Rama had to go into war with to win Sita back, and he's 10 heads. It's kind of a monster, a Rakshasa monster. Is Ravana as good of a manifestation of Ishvara as Rama, you know, or whatever you want to say. Is a good person a better manifestation of Ishvara than a bad person, so-called? No, not really. The whole thing is a manifestation of Ishvara, you know. But the Jiva Srishti, each individual's Jiva Srishti, you know, is a manifested, more of a manifestation of, because coming from the Jiva, even though it's still within Ishvara, still it's coming from the Jiva. So that can be, that Jiva Srishti can be more a manifestation of Dharma or a manifestation of Adharma. It can be the manifestation of Sattva or manifestation of Rajas or a manifestation of Tamas or predominantly. And so you get kind of a very colorful display in terms of the types of personalities and what is kind of the container for the antikarana. Is it primarily sattva? And actually in chapter 17 and 18, Krishna breaks it out like this. You know, the brahmanas would be predominantly sattva with rojas secondarily. The kshatriyas would be predominantly rajas with sattva. And then the vaishyas are rajas with tamas. And then the shudras, secondary tamas. And the shudras are tamas with rajas. And so those are just a way of categorizing people into four groups, basically, four different types. So they're going to have different mix of prakriti, we call prakriti. So in the Bhagavad Gita, in one of the verses, which I don't even remember the chapter now, but Bhagavan says, all of this is just the play of prakriti. Prakriti is maya. This is nothing but, you know, all of your thoughts, all of your activities in the whole world is just nothing but the play of prakriti. Sattva, rajas, and tamas. And so that can be very light and sattvic, or very dull and tamasic, or very kind of rajasic tamasic, which can be very kind of cruel. You know, so all of it is part of, is a play of the prakriti, play of the maya. Sometimes it's hard to see that we don't really need anything because we're already fullness. Maybe that means I don't have to help out of guilt. I don't have to help out of guilt because I am fullness anyway. I mean, for a person who gives more than he or she is able to. I understand that helping and contributing to the world gives great shanti and is good for the human heart. What if you have been giving the whole life but more out of guilt and fear? And not listening to your own basic needs, like having to rest, eat properly, etc. If you can't, when you find that you're, one way, let me put it this way, I think you recognize that you don't have adequate boundaries in place when you get your giving or helping starts to make you resentful. Resentful or tired or irritable, you know, or critical of other people because they're not helping as much as you are. And so you get kind of a burned out. But then that's not healthy for anybody. You're not really helping anybody if you're helping them from a resentful burnout place. You know, people don't like to be helped in that way. And the reason that we do that is just often because we don't know how to say no in a way that is not hurtful, you know. And I think the only reason that that happens to us is that we put off setting boundaries until we're already angry. And then it's hard, then angrily, because you're already irritated and angry, then you say no and put up the boundary. But once you become really comfortable with putting up the boundaries, then there's no anger at all, you know, because you're very comfortable saying, I can't do that right now, or I'll do my best, but it's not possible now, or whatever. Whatever you say, but there's no anger in it at all. And everybody will just say, for the most part, say, yeah, that's fine, I understand. And there's no bad feelings, there's no anger, there's nothing. You know, so you have to be kind of attuned. You start becoming, I'm just talking from my own experience of having a burnout once when I was running, I was the manager of the ashram on the East Coast at Arshavidya Gurukulam. I was managing that for several years. And it got to a place where I didn't really want to be doing what I was doing at all. And I became kind of resentful, which I didn't even really realize yet until one of the staff there had a really easy job, you know. He had this easy job. And he could take lots of time off and go do this and go do that. And I was just working all day long, every day, you know. And so I found my mind starting to compare, you know. This guy has all this time off and she's doing that, and, you know. And not feeling very happy about it, you know. And then I realized, I kind of started paying attention to myself, how I was feeling and thinking about it. And I thought, you are burnt out. You're really burnt out. You have to pull back. Because it's not right for any of those people. You become a really bad manager because you're just saying, you're taking time off. You're not working hard enough. All of this nonsense, in the sense that it's the voice of a person who's just really exhausted and tired and burnt out and doesn't know how to manage her time. You know, delegate properly, and then not knowing how to say no either. So these are the things that we have to learn in terms of any kind of job that you're doing, or any nonprofit that you're doing, any kind of work that you're doing. You have to manage it in such a way that you don't become, you know, resentful and irritated and all of these things. So if you are resentful and irritated, it means you have to take stock of yourself and see, I'm not doing something right here. I think it's in terms of learning how to say no. Once I learned how to say no, or to catch the thing early enough so that you can say no. Say no stands for setting any kind of boundary, whatever that may be. If you catch that early enough, there really isn't any problem, you know, because you haven't waited until you're so frustrated and irritated that your no is very cranky, cranky no. So it's management like that. And then just like in your, I mean, I can relate to this, where, like when you say, you say, yeah. See, what if you have been giving the whole life, but more out of guilt and fear, not listening to your own basic needs, like having to rest, eat properly, etc.? That's the problem. Like, if you're giving more out of guilt and fear and trying to be a good person, you can have a whole list of things, reasons like that, that you're doing it. Those reasons aren't really the reasons to be doing it. So then we have to do that inner work, being with the guilt and fear and seeing what that's about and what you're really afraid of. And if you think God is a punishing God, and you won't be accruing punya, you know, God will be angry at you. You know, the pictures of God with the thunderbolt and the lightning and the thunderbolt, those are Judeo-Christian pictures of God standing there waiting in judgment on you. Somebody not thinking you're good enough, all of these kind of things. But these are all the things that we have to work on to straighten out these complexes. They're all complexes. So just the fact that you're aware of it is a really good thing. It was kind of disappointing. Like, you realize, wow, I've been spent my whole life just giving, 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 just out of guilt and fear. That's the motivating factor. That is depressing. But it's a good thing to recognize, you know. Find a different motivation. For us, I think, once you become a mumukshu or you're gaining knowledge, I think that the motivations change. It all becomes about antakarana shuddhi. You know, you give as much as you can, or you do as much as you can. It's not really for anyone else. It's for your own antakarana shuddhi, for your own freedom, for your own fullness. You know, and so you do everything for that antakarana shuddhi, for your heart being as big as Ishvara. And so you push yourself to whatever degree you can, and then you back off. The whole life is about antakarana shuddhi. It's about moksha, about really owning this knowledge, you know. And the mind, it has an emotional lag time to your knowledge, always. Because we have beginningless lifetimes of taking myself to be mortal, you know, and trying to live my life and make my life be a happy life and all of that. You know, so that's, those kind of samskaras are there, and they slowly drop off, because in fact that orientation is delusional. Because what it means is that the happiness is out here to be attained, and it just simply isn't. And you discover that at some point, that's part of becoming a mumukshu, that just simply isn't true. If it were true, then you found your happy object, and then that's that. You've got your happy object. But no, many things can happen, but somebody could take your happy object away. But even more shocking than that, is that you get to keep the happy object, but the happiness goes away. You still have the object, but you don't have the happiness that it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be a happy object. It's not a happy object. It was only a happy object for a little while. And now it's just an object. It's a garage sale item. Yeah. That's really something to really comprehend, you know, to really notice the reality of that, you know. It helps to make you a mumukshu. So you have to realize that something's wrong here. This isn't real. It's not real. The ananda, belonging to the object, going after it, getting it, I mean, a moment of happiness, and the whole thing goes away. Something wrong. And there's no exceptions. It continually happens to you, and it happens to everybody else. And at some point, I think the mind has had enough. And it allows itself to notice this very obvious fact. You know, it's a very, very obvious fact, but we don't want to know that. So we just move on to the next thing. We don't want to assimilate our experiences until it's really, we really have to. Because once you start assimilating your experiences, you know, then you do become a mumukshu. Your mind has to be ready to put kind of a simple two and two together. So simple once you know. Once you see it, it's so simple. But that's how, I mean, even Einstein would say that. These big, complex things that are impossible to solve, but once they're solved, they're so simple. They're so pure. They're so pure and, you know, beautifully put together. Makes so much sense, but only once you see it. So. Can you suggest as a Panchadashi book to keep on studying the text? I have a couple of them. I think I have two of them here. They're the same book with just different covers. And I don't know of a good book that has a commentary. I wish Swamiji would have done that. Probably, I don't know that any that we've made commentaries out of any of the classes. I think I would go to see if online, I would get any book. The translations aren't that great, but it doesn't really matter if you get, like, Paramarthananda. He's done a lot of Panchadashi. If you can get his, one of his students, I think, takes really kind of meticulous notes and then writes them up. But you can also listen to his talks on Panchadashi. So that with the notes from the student, which you can just print out. And that's probably what I would suggest. And if Swamiji's taught several chapters of Panchadashi, and at some point, I think they'll be transcribed, you know. And also there's probably chapter 1, 7, 10, and maybe 15. I know that he's taught. I don't know if he's taught other ones. He might have in some of the other courses. But you can also listen to those tapes. But I feel that unless you have quite a bit of knowledge, the translations are not that good, and the Sanskrit is quite terse. And so it's better to get somebody like Paramarthananda or Swamiji, if he has them. But I know Paramarthananda does. And then read those commentaries. That's what I would do. He's very thorough.
Does he have a website?
He doesn't have a website, but some of his students have a website, which I don't remember offhand. I know what it is, but you can always email me. I think Sky probably knows.
I don't know it offhand either.
Yeah, I do. I don't know it offhand, but I can easily get it. I just don't have it memorized. It's a little, you can get on their mailing list, and I can send it to you. Just say, can you give me Paramarthananda's Panchadashi? And most of it is free. Yeah. That's the best thing to do with. There's a lot of audio tapes, you know, by Swamiji. They're on CDs mostly. And I think by Paramarthananda. Most of them, they're not, if you're buying them in India, they're not very expensive. And then a lot of us have them. They're just passed down through the parampara. All the serious students of Vedanta, if you like Swami or Sakshat Kritananda, give a dump this whole huge, you know, pile of texts on us, on many of us. So you can usually get one from another student. And there's no problem with that. Nobody minds. It's meant to be passed around to all of us. And if you can't find what you want, you might be able to get it from the bookstore at Coimbatore, but you watch out. we haven't had the best experience with that. Maybe if it's just sending one disc or something, that'd be okay.
Yeah. Seems like they're coming now. Books.
They are in Rome, actually.
They're in Rome?
Yeah.
Oh, we can pass them out at the last day of class.
Yeah.
And take our books home with us. That would be good. I mean, I really would love you to get the, especially the Kena Upanishad. I don't know what else has been ordered.
Tattva Bodha.
Oh, the Tattva Bodha is a beautiful book too. Yeah. Yeah, Tattva Bodha and Kena. It'd be really nice. You'd love to read it now, I think. It's really good. Yeah. You talked about not seeing money as security. You talked about not seeing money as security, and I see how money is not something stable and secure. You talked about how you in the ashram only had money for the day, Swamiji I was talking about, and practiced not to worry. But the ashram was supported only by donation. How can you translate that into a Western example? I think it's just much more harrowing. To me, it feels more peaceful for the mind to have a budget. Don't buy things when I can't afford. And I like to have a regular income. I see many people in the spiritual world living more in uncertainty, going with the flow, and where that also becomes anxiety because of not knowing how to get around. Can you clarify how to relate to money?
Well,
I think, I mean, it is nice to have a steady income coming in, as long as, I mean, I like that. I like at school, I get my paycheck and all that, and I really like that. But what I don't want, and I can fall into something like this where I'll keep that doing that job so that I can get the paycheck, but not because that's really what I want to be doing. So I'm kind of walking that line right now. I want to make sure that the reason I'm staying on, you know, is for what for me would be appropriate reasons, and not because I don't want to take the risk of not having, you know, a steady paycheck. And I think with Swamiji, when I was talking about it, I was talking about him when I was talking about how he ran the ashram. He had a certain shraddha, and he was very, it's not that he was never loose or lax with funds or some sort of a spendthrift, and not at all. But he also wasn't afraid. And so he was doing what was obviously he was meant to do and what was his prarabdha, and he trusted Ishwara, you know, would do what it was required, but it certainly would give what's required at the right time. But he had no laziness in him at all. I mean, he got up every morning, and he wouldn't think of it like this, but he worked all day until 11 or 12 at night, and then, you know, he had the bathroom to himself, basically. And people would wait for him to get out of the bathroom. So, that sounds kind of crude to say, but that was a fact, and we all knew it, and we all recognized it, that there was very, very little free time, and he just went ahead, and he did this, and then he did this, and then he did this, and he didn't worry about anything else. It'll take care of itself. You know, and then he also had a certain freedom, and if it doesn't, I'll just go to Rishikesh, and it's fine. And just go and not do all this because it's not supported, so there's nothing, we'll just move on. So he had that tremendous freedom, and at the same time he had a tremendous work ethic, you know. And he used to get sore throats and things quite a bit, probably because of so much talking. But once he said, I remember we were walking to the lecture hall, and he said, I don't feel like I've earned my daily bread unless I'm teaching. He meant it too. That's what he does, is teach, and that's the main thing. He doesn't feel like he's earned his daily bread unless he's teaching. But he also all those years that I spent with him in administrative roles and all of this, he had no fear, you know. If there was, like a lot of times in India, there's big droughts. This was in the 70s. There were a lot of droughts where it was very, very hard to find rice, you know, and food. And so he would just call all over India. And these were trunk calls. They weren't, I don't know if you remember this, like in the 70s, you don't just pick up the phone and dial somebody. You have to tell the operator, then the operator has to work on it, getting this call to go through. If you're, you know, unless it's just in that local area. So then the operator would then work on trying to get the call through, and then the trunk call would come, and they'd take the phone to Swamiji, and then he'd be connected. So he would be just calling on all of these different countries, well, I mean states within India, to try to get enough grain to be able to feed the 65 students or so that were there that needed to be fed every day, you know. And he did that. And he took care of the ashram up in Rishikesh also. Because he could, because he did. He just did it. Yeah. He didn't have any fear. Everybody needs to eat, so let's find the food. But it's just the relaxation. The relaxation and along with the requisite effort that was necessary to do that. But he always did it in such a relaxed way. He was relaxed, but he was relaxedly doing everything that had to be done, you know. I used to think when I was used to kind of work out or go to the gym and these kind of things, and we'd try to do all of our little exercises and work these machines and all that. I did that at one time many years ago. But I used to think that when you do these exercises that you have to, you know, really work, like say if you're lifting a weight or something or pushing these things, that your muscles are kind of tense and you're really trying to do it, you know. And it's actually supposed to be just the opposite. You should do all of these things with, like yoga, you're not keeping your muscles all tight and tense. You're just, you know, doing the whatever it is. Even if it's lifting weights or whatever, you're not getting all tense about it. You're just simply doing it and letting the muscles do the job in a relaxed way. And I learned from Swamiji, that's how he does all kinds of work, mostly mental work. You know, it's not like you have to make him exercise. We had to get him a walker so that he could go downstairs and walk for half an hour. You know, the last thing he wanted to do. So get him on this walker. He'd walk for half an hour, and while he was doing that, one of the students who was working on transcribing these texts and writing the texts for him would come and read the version of the text that needed to be, of his text that needed to be edited. And so they'd be reading the text, he'd be listening as he's walking along, you know. He has to walk for half an hour, but all the while he's doing this editing of the text. And then that was good. Not wasting any time. Yeah. But relaxed. That's the thing. He was relaxed and doing, but without any tension. So. And also not careless or just wasting money. He didn't waste, but he wasn't afraid of money, spending money either. He just didn't waste it. So I think there's certain attitudes that just show you're doing your part, Ishwara's. You're doing your part within your prarabdha, and Ishwara's supporting it. And if he doesn't, he'll do something else, because that's not what Bhagavan's doing right now. And so that job is over. See what the next thing is. It's a tremendous amount of freedom. You have to kind of grow into that. That freedom, and also your own, I don't know, just lack of laziness or something, where you're actually participating in your life. I don't know if that makes sense. I don't know quite what language to use. We can get kind of slothful and lazy and depressed, or, you know, not really alive to life. But if you're alive to what you're doing and you're behind what you're doing, then I think the creation supports it. And that's another one of those things that you have to experiment with, you know, to get more and more shraddha in the fact of that. So.
A little basket.
Time for one more question.
Yeah.
if you know how to answer this, but it's just curious, how was Swamiji able to say no that sounded like he was saying yes?
That's a good question. He certainly did it all the time. I know he used to say things like, if there was no immediate answer or he couldn't promise anything, he'd say, let's think about it, let's wait and see, you know. He'll say things like that, and then he'll say, let me just think for a minute. Well, he would also say, because he always had so many people that needed to see him, that he would spend 10 to 15 minutes with people, which is not very long. But he was totally present for it. And there would be, the thing is this was interesting. He started ending up seeing people, you know, when he was in Sailorsburg, at the ashram in Sailorsburg. He would be in the living room. They built a little room, right? That little room off the living room. And so he would go into the living, instead of having satsang, which is kind of a sad thing, instead of having satsang with the whole group of us, there were so many people who wanted to talk privately with him. And the students, as well as a lot of Indian families and people coming in for the day, maybe driving long distances to see him. And so there would be, sometimes I would go up there to that living room, there'd be like 20, 25 people there waiting to see him. And so I think it was a real toughness. He would end up sitting in that room for hours and seeing everybody for 15 minutes, sometimes longer, depending on what to sit, one after another. And then Dr. Gita would bring in tea, you know. And also, there would be phone calls coming continually on top of that. So it was kind of overwhelming, really. And then Swamiji would feel like these people have come, you know, and they have to go back. So he can't send, they've come all the way to see him. They're not going to be staying overnight. They have to go back. And so that would be one more person, but there would be so many people like that. And then the people who were staying there or living there, or if it was a camp, then they would be the last ones to be seen. These new people would keep arriving. And then sometimes it would be actually like 11:30 or 12 before he was just it was over. He couldn't do any more. And that would be hard on him if he knew that those people wouldn't be able to see him then, because they're his devotees and he also wants to see them. So then he would just stay up later. So that's how he was from morning till night. So that's not very good at saying no in that way, you know. But then he didn't want to say no. When he wanted to say no, it always seemed to be, now that I'm really kind of thinking about it, kind of like a group decision. It's like you and I are deciding not to do that right now. Yeah. It wasn't just him saying no, it's something that we were saying together almost. And all, that's fine, Swamiji. Yeah. Because there was nothing in him where you felt rejected by him, or that He just didn't want to do it for you. He didn't want to be with you. So you never felt that. You just felt that we can't do it right now. And so the no's were... And I think that's part of it, is that's kind of how he felt. He didn't have that rejection in him. Not really. I may have seen some exhaustion. One time he was really sick. So you have to think, this is over 40 years. One time I saw he was really, really sick, actually. And so I saw him get a little testy when he was really sick. And one time I think I saw him fed up. Just kind of had it. He's getting pushed too hard by someone. And he kind of, you know, snapped back a little bit. So that's two times in all those years. It's pretty good. But it means, you know, you could probably push in. You have to push really hard for a really, really long time where he has to be very, very sick. I think the best thing to way to understand it is that he didn't feel no inside. He was just going to do it right now. It's like when I was talking about these all these people lining up with the really big problems. They need a lot of money to help put their child through school. And so many crucial things. And they knew that if anybody would help them, it would be Swamiji. All of the villagers around Coimbatore knew that. Swamiji had that reputation. He will help. He will help. And they were right. He would help, and he wanted to help. And if he could possibly help, he would. And he's also very circumspect about it because, like, for instance, some children needed to be, you had to pay for the school, so the school had to be paid for, the college had to be paid for. And so since Swamiji had a good staff of people working with him, so he would not give the people the money. He would give to the staff, he would say, you arrange for this boy, you know, the boy would usually be there. You arrange for this boy to go to this school. You take care of it. And so the whoever it was, like Nayarji or one of Swamiji's, you know, brahmacharis, they would actually take care of it. They would do all of the financial arrangement directly with the school so that the boy actually would get to go to school, because sometimes the money was so tight that if they gave the money to the family, then immediately something else happens and they need the money for that, and so then they don't have the money for the boy to go to school, this type of thing. So he knew all of that. And so he always arranged for these things to be, these big things to be directly taken care of, which I think was really smart, because what happens, you get this money and of course all you want is for your child to go to school, but then there's these emergencies. So the money goes to those emergencies. So he was he knew all of that and said he handled it all really well. The whole room would be almost standing room in Coimbatore. They'd all be standing there. And then there was this little, like say this was Swamiji's asana, Swamiji was sitting here, then there'd be this little space here that where people weren't standing, that all around they'd be standing. And they would just take turns, and they'd come and sit in the Swamiji, and they would talk about this, and Swamiji would take care of it, and the next person would come up. So that's how he spent his time, his free time, so much. Certain times of the day that the people knew that he would be there. And he just kept giving. Until there was nothing left to give, and then there's nothing left to give, so we have to wait so while, you know. But he used to, in class, sometimes tell stories about people who had that gift of giving. And he talked about this one family, and I don't know who they were, but anyway, he talked about this one family, and the head of the family was the matriarch, the mother, I guess, who was the grandmother, you know. And then she had her children and their children's children. But everything was kind of handled by the matriarch. And she was a very, very giving, very generous person. So she used to support so many things and give and give, give. She was just a big giver all the time, giving, giving, giving. And their property and their income and all of that, I forget what they were doing, but it always prospered. They had more and more and more money, and she gave and gave and gave. That's what she did. She was the giver. She gave and gave and gave and helped so many people. And And like in Swamiji's language, Bhagavan really rewarded her because there more and more and more money came, but the more money that came, the more she gave. And then when she finally passed away, then the children were in charge. The boys were in charge. And because it was usually passed down through the men in the way the inheritance would work often. The lands and everything were always given like to the eldest son and then divided up. So these boys were given all of the wealth was over to them, but they didn't have this giving, you call it, it was like a giving vibhuti. They didn't have that. And so they were much more tight-fisted. And so what Swamiji said was, as that tight-fistedness came, all of the money dried up. And it was actually, it wasn't a made-up story, it was actually something real, but he was telling that story just for Shraddha, you know, just for Shraddha, for Dharma, that don't be afraid to give. The more you give, the more you get. You know, not just with money, but with everything. Another, just a little aside to that is, say you think in terms of wealth, the more you give, the more you get, the more you, because there's a flow. You're just opening up the flow. Also with knowledge, the more you give, the more you get, the more you give, the more you get. And then, so there's that. And we all experience that as we start to teach. Bhagavan gives so much. Everything you give, you get way more than what you give. And it just keeps a flow of knowledge coming. And then he also said, it's considered in India that what everything that you know, like say, if, for instance, if you're a teacher, you may be a cook or a musician or you're a Vedanta teacher or you're a yoga teacher, whatever you're teaching, you have to teach everything. You cannot hold back. And then he gives the example of a cook who was a famous chef. You know, who taught the sishas, his students, everything except for the primary little ingredients that made his cooking so special. That little thing he held back. Okay, so that is considered a great papa. You have to give all, everything. You cannot hold, as a teacher, you have to give everything. You can't hold anything back. Teach you how to cook, but you know what? I'm not going to tell you this, but it'll never be as good as my cooking because I've kept for secret these special ingredients. You know? Or say for music. Music is such a thing that, you know, there's that guru, that music to teach everything about how to, like for singing, how really to project the voice and all of these type of things. You know, you have to give all of it. If you hold anything back, that's considered a great papa. So that's a nice thing to know. It doesn't mean everybody has to be a teacher, but if you are a teacher, then you have to give everything. Don't hold anything back. It makes sense too. That's it. Om Swasti Prajapya Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Ko Brahmane Vyashupamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho yam shobharahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayah Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha. Sarve santu niramayaha. Sarve bhadrani pashyantu. Ma kaschit dukha bhag bhavet. Asato ma sadgamaya. Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya. Mrityorma amritangamaya. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
Another day.
What? Rest well.
Thank you. I will.